The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Okay, let's get through some of your comments here. Thanks so much for texting. A caller says, my health insurance for myself and my wife is €290 per month. I claim virtually nothing, but like car insurance, I may need it someday for things like hip or knee replacement or some other unforeseen medical issue. I've paid in far more than I'll ever claim back. Now, I do have an understanding, of course, but like, say, for instance, you're paying $290 a month. If, God forbid, you had an issue with your hip or knee or replacement, would you not sort of get that done on the cross-border purchase scheme? Would you get in quicker? Would you get it done? I don't know. €290 a month for two people, a lot of money. But, of course, it's if you can afford it, it is obviously good value. Not good value, worthwhile. Every greenfield hedge, tree, forest, bush, shrub, plant in Ireland is capturing carbon. We need to save our farmers and protect our farms. Don't be fooled, people, says a listener. A caller is a retained firefighter and wants to know, can it be confirmed that Karen O'Loughlin from SIPTU, who's been fighting their corner, will no longer be taking part in negotiations on behalf of the firefighters with her move to the Department of Education? Now, I wasn't familiar with that move, one perhaps that wouldn't surprise me. Is it, when you say the Department of Education, is that within SIPTU or within government? We'll try and get some clarity for you, of course. When people paying mega money for their NCT to maintain their cars to make sure they're fit for the road, bloody hell, exercise in futility, if you ask me, when the government is not paying the money to maintain the infrastructure of roads, potholes, uneven roads, death traps, etc. And it is a factor. There's a couple of factors in the safety of our roads. There's the driver, there's a vehicle, and there is the roads. And I have said it many a time on this programme, I don't think there's enough emphasis on the latter in terms of the conversation. Yes, the car, yes, the driver, but the road is an important factor there. Greg, our roads need urgent attention. It's a disgrace. The roads are dangerous. More deaths on our roads now. Potholes galore. Waterlogged drains that cause flooding. Again, a danger zone. Are any of the politicians listening, or is it falling on deaf ears? They're all attentive when it comes to wanting votes. When they come to your door with their begging bowls out, promises. Greg, we live in a family housing estate in Letterkenny. Two houses have been let out as Airbnbs, but they are party houses that sleep 12 and have bunk beds. We're sick of the pollution and noise and feel as though we have no rights, not fair at all. Again, this is why these conversations are so valuable. In all of the chat, there was no reference to that. It's come in now from a couple of listeners saying, look at, you know, what about living beside them? Is that a particular problem? Let us know. 086 60 25,000 certainly is for a couple of listeners so far. If there is no services available, then funding should be made available for private service services. I imagine that's to do with the CAMS shortfalls. It's globalisation that's causing homelessness, and the Americans are saying so. First time ever in my life, I agree with Micheál. Dunfanaghy is a prime example. Here, locals priced out of it. If any area notices a build-up of tourists, then maybe locals should be encouraged to buy local buildings and renovate them to Airbnb. Keep businesses local. Areas all over Europe are complaining about over-tourism. We won't be beautiful, clean, rural, green if we're packed with tourists, says a listener. Another, the only people to blame for the state of our country and the price of houses, rent, everything, is our government. Nobody else. We need to get our government out and get somebody new and who's actually going to put the people before money. And there was a big hoo-ha. Do you might remember, and loads of people shared it on social media, about new regulations about home ownership and what you can do with your home. And it was attributed to the government, but it wasn't the government that was coming up with that idea at all, in fairness. I believe it was people before profit. I'll double-check that to make sure I'm correct. But do you know where it was like they want to regulate what you can do with your homes and all this kind of stuff? It wasn't coming from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. It was coming from opposition parties, some of them, some of the smaller ones, if my memory serves me correctly. Right, we got an email in, and this is an issue we're going to return to next week. But I wanted to read the email, give you an opportunity to sort of consume it and think about it. And maybe then if you want to get involved in the conversation a little later on, because we're going to speak to someone with direct knowledge of this case. And it is a listener that says they want to raise awareness of how the gastric sleeve impacted someone close to them. Would like to hear a balanced discussion on this. I'm of the opinion that unless you are clinically obese and it's a matter of life or death, then it is a very drastic option. It seems only the positives are shown in the media or social media, people half their weight. Not as much about the impact on health, dumping syndrome, psychological issues, blood sugar issues, malnutrition, etc. The people who have it for cosmetic reasons are perhaps ill-informed, and it is worth noting the side effects undoubtedly contribute to our already chock-a-block waiting lists for hospitals and GP visits. Regular blood tests are required, monthly or even weekly, to review patients and regular review appointments. Is this fair? I just wish our health service put more investment in prevention. Social media has so much to answer for in terms of body image. It's scary. As a parent, it's almost impossible to ensure a healthy diet for children. We can do our very best, but junk food is everywhere. Other people offer treats constantly, and it's very hard to say no as the children see everything else eating unhealthily. Yes, the schools try, but I mean situations like, say, Christmas, a selection box, no longer a treat, one at every corner you turn, kids coming out of shops with a 2 euro mix rather than a 10 pence mix like we had. I know eating unhealthily isn't the only reason for people requiring gastric sleeves. My heart goes out to those who absolutely need the surgery. But for those having cosmetic surgery, please think twice. It's a major surgery. There are side effects mentally and physically. You need to have medical and psychological support in your own country throughout your journey, as many call it. Just remember, whether successful or not, it comes with complications. The surgery is lifelong and irreversible. That's someone with personal knowledge that didn't that had a devastating consequence for someone close to them. As I say, we'll chat about that a little later on next week. And as I said, and when we talked about this earlier, and I've interviewed people whose lives have just been completely and utterly reformed for the better as a result of this type of a surgery, this type of intervention. But that doesn't mean, of course, especially considering that people are going out for this surgery and not returning home or dying once they come home, that we have a full rounded conversation so everyone goes into it with their eyes wide open. Now, Aaron Gallagher is from Killybegs and joins us on the programme now. Hi, Aaron, how are you keeping?
I'm good, Greg. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, it's important that we do, and thanks for emailing us. Tell us your story, Aaron, and we'll get to your dilemma then through the course of that, of course.
So basically, I'm going into final year of physiotherapy in UL, and just a wee background on the course, we are required to complete 1,000 hours of placement before we can register with the governing body, which is CARU in Ireland, and we're due to start our next placement on Monday. I'm actually driving down to Limerick today. But there is a strike action being put into place on September 11th. It's been carried out by FORSA, which is basically just a trade union which represents like all the allied health professionals, so physio, OT, etc. And their main action is that they don't want to take on, or they're ceasing to take on student placements. And like, while I support the action of my future colleagues, like, it is affecting our upcoming placement, which is putting a lot of personal pressure on students.
Yeah, and it leaves you in a bit of a dilemma, isn't it? Because this is the future career that you want to go into, and you can understand perhaps the reasons behind it. But why should it affect, you know, the future physiotherapists, etc.? It seems really unfair, but it leaves you in a kind of an awkward situation.
Yeah, it does. And I'm lucky enough, my placement's in Limerick, so my accommodation will be in Limerick anyway, even if we have to return to college. But I know a lot of my friends, they're in Castlebar in Mayo, or they're in Galway, and they have rented out their rooms in Limerick for the time they're on placement. And if we end up having to come back to college because our placement isn't going ahead, they have nowhere to live. And then they're after paying rent for somewhere else in a different county. So it just is a lot of pressure at the minute with the accommodation crisis and everything. Yeah, and as well, it's delaying. It could potentially delay our graduation as well, which obviously nobody wants, because we all want to enter the workforce in 2024. But if this doesn't get sorted, that might potentially be disrupted.
Yeah, because 1,000 hours is a lot, and that all has to be done in the final year. So any delays in that obviously then could push back the whole process.
Yeah, well, we've completed 500 hours already, but we still have 500 hours left to go, which is roughly 15 weeks. So it's kind of, you don't need any delays to that.
Now, is this part of the action, part of the work to rule action, or is this the actual focus of it to not support your work experience?
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure. All I know is that how it's affecting us. And that's one of the actions anyway, that's been taken as part of the work to rule. It was kind of highlighted to us on the 17th of August that this might be a possibility. But just as we're creeping closer to placement, it doesn't seem to be getting resolved. I've emailed the Donegal TDs, but I don't know will I get any reply, just because I know they're still in their summer break at the minute. But our college course, we're all trying to take action ourselves in our own counties, but we just don't know what's going to happen. It's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, and as you say, an awful lot of stress in terms of just the progression of the education, but also the financial impact, the paying double rent, securing rent accommodation for specific periods of time, having to maintain that or not maintain that. It's really, really messy for a lot of students.
Yeah, and it's in a time where it's stressful enough already. You know, you're in your final year. This is the one that matters the most and is most heavily weighted. And we have a project to do, you know, as well. And it's just a lot of uncertainty and very frustrating.
And you don't know what to do. I mean, do you try and adjust these leases? Because it's open-ended, you know, there's not really an awful lot one can do if you had to secure accommodation for a placement. You don't know when you might actually be able to avail of it now. And as you say, there is a, and we all know, there is a huge accommodation shortage at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I know it's a big stress on a lot of people. The other thing that we were thinking might happen is if we had to make up hours during Christmas or like next summer or at the weekend. But the one thing I'll say about that is, like, obviously a lot of students are supporting themselves through college through part-time jobs, and our placement's currently unpaid. So, like, the impact for us, basically, the main one is our graduation, the loss of money due to rent and accommodation, and then plus potentially the loss of income if we have to make it up during a time we'd normally be working to help us get through college.
So what is the situation now for you, Erin? Like, when, I know you've sort of mentioned it, but I want to recap. When was your placement due to begin, and what is the status of that as we speak right now?
So right now, we are starting placement on the 4th of September.
Right.
And my current understanding of the situation is we are on placement from the 4th to the 9th. And then our last day, or the 8th, I think maybe. And then our last day will be the 8th if this continues to go ahead. And then they're striking from the 11th of September. So then after that, it's uncertainty. Nobody really knows.
And of course, then in terms of even being able to register as their physiotherapist, this all obviously complicates that process.
Yeah, because CARU is our governing body, and it's, you have to have 1,000 hours. And if you don't have the 1,000 hours, you can't register. So it just does mean that, like, we would be delayed in graduating, and we'd be delayed in entering the workforce. And, you know, just nobody wants that. Everybody wants to get out and get working, you know.
Now, obviously, as you said, and you understand, this is part of a wider action. Allied health professionals working with the HSE, the likes of dietitians, occupational therapy, social work, speech and language therapy. This is all going to have a potential impact on lots of people out there, not least you, the students as well. Hopefully it is obviously the first thing you'd want is presumably for the unions calls to be heard. But would you see as a compromise maybe to understand that you guys are the future of these of these disciplines, and that maybe your work placements could continue even while this industrial action continues? Sorry about the convoluted question, Erin, but is that an option?
No. Yeah, well, that would kind of be the hope. You know, I obviously hope for the sake of, like, my future colleagues and even my own future that this could be sorted, but at the same time, in my present moment, this is greatly affecting me and, like, my graduating class. Like, we want to go on placement. We have been preparing the summer for it, you know, and, like, the best way to kind of learn all this stuff is to get out there and do it. So that would kind of be the hope, that it comes to some sort of conclusion, that, they can come to an agreement that we can still carry out our placements.
Okay, fingers crossed, because we need people, lots of people in these disciplines. Erin, thank you. I hope you get a response from the TDs and they hear you as well. Thanks very much indeed. Erin Gallagher, who's from Killybegs and a student in her final year undergraduate physiotherapy in the University of Limerick. And as you heard from her, really quite clearly in quite a pickle, quite a dilemma there. More of your comments here regarding the waiting time for the RSA driving test. A family member applied in May for their test. Checked on the website last night. Estimated test date week beginning the 25th of December. This is Buncrana Test Centre. That's May to December. I don't need to go. We know all the reasons why it's so important that people can get on the roads, don't we? But that's an awful wait. And the problem with it is that, firstly, that's Christmas week, so obviously it's a computer. And it's probably going to be January, but it could be February, it could be March, who's to say? That's an awful wait. Applied in May for their test on the website last night, 25th of December is when they could expect to be called for their test. In fact, it's actually not called for the test. That's when you're invited to book your test. So it could be another 2 or 3 weeks thereafter if they even stick to that date. So booked a driving test in May 2022. Unless something drastically changes, they're not going to be able to sit it till January 2024. How frustrating is that? Greg, 2 adults and 4 children, basic health with VHI at the minute is at minimum cover is €150 a month. So that sounds like it must be the minimum then, which is €1,300 a year. Good morning. If a person registers with an agency as a healthcare assistant or nurse, if you're offered a job, for example, by the HSC at a latter stage, would you be able to leave the agency? As I've heard from other people say that if you sign a contract with an agency, you have to keep the agreement and cannot leave. Anyone with an insight in that? I'm sure there are people out there who know exactly what that's about. 086 60 25,000. Please get in touch and help that listener if you can. Yes, Greg, most of us are rebelling against corruption, not just in RTE, but in the administration as a whole, says a listener. Health insurance for our family, €3,600 a year. Note, no family policies, only individual members on the policy. Anti-family, like many policies, more money in individualisation. €3,600 is some bills. Now, I presume there are various packages that you can go for. CAMS, Tuzla, Court Service, HSE, Housing, etc. Unfit for purpose. Do we see a long-running theme here? Poor management planning caused by yes men and women recruited or promoted into areas of responsibility by the Tweedledee Tweedledum controlled establishment. Back to Airbnbs. We need Airbnbs because most of our hotels are full with Ukrainians. Donegal needs tourism and Airbnb is the only answer to that. And other vacant houses in Donegal must be empty for 2 years before you can apply for help to renovate them. That is why there is an issue with homelessness in Donegal. Another, we need tourism in our county. It's our biggest contributor to the local economy. I would like to rent via Airbnb next summer, but I would never rent full time as I wouldn't be able to take back the house when I wanted. The state needs to build social housing. Micheál, you're so right. Homes should be for families. I feel the council have a lot to answer for. They're refusing planning to locals on their own land and yet allowing all kinds of developments happen around us. My son was refused planning and despite changing the plans to suit all requests, it was still refused. Yet a family from Northern Ireland next door got planning with no issues. And you can imagine the frustration that causes there. And look at the county, look at the national development plan. It's all about moving us into cities and towns, and the country is no place, you're not encouraged in the country or in rural Ireland, sorry, should I say, seemingly anymore. Now, up to 1 in 3 adults wake up with chronic pain most days, but many still battle to have the debilitating condition, I beg your pardon, taken seriously by doctors. They can also face disbelief from family, friends and employers. It emerged in a recent study. Martina Phelan is chair of Chronic Pain Ireland and joins us on the programme. Thanks for your time today, Martina. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg. Delighted to be here.
Is the difficulty that it's not visible? Is that why it's difficult for people to understand or to relate?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at somebody with chronic pain, you can't see anything. Whereas you look at somebody with a broken leg, and you can immediately see, oh, their leg is broken, you know, give them a bit of sympathy, etc. Chronic pain, being an invisible illness, causes a huge amount of difficulty for people, not just in walking down the street or living their lives, but even with medical personnel. You know, you can get all sorts of disbelief from around.
And what is your situation? You've lived with chronic pain from birth, as much as you're comfortable in saying, Martina, obviously. What is your life with chronic pain like?
It's been difficult. I suppose my actual pain would have started in my teenage years. And like that, I wasn't believed for years. You know, I was put off with, oh, the school bag is too heavy, etc. You're overweight, period pain. And that would be quite common. It wasn't until I was nearly 30 that I was diagnosed with chronic pain. And then I got to see a pain specialist. And up to that, I'd been struggling. I'd been going to different doctors. I'd been going to physiotherapists, all out of my own pocket now. Mm. And still working and studying as well. And
No problem.
The first thing the pain specialist said to me when I went in, and I'll never forget it, and it made the biggest impact on my life, was, your pain is real.
Wow.
That was the very first thing he said to me. And then he got me on a medication regimen and a treatment regimen. And that changed my life. You know, the pain isn't gone. It's still there. It affects my mobility as well. I walk with a stick now. But for a lot of people, they don't need the extra aids, so it still can't be seen. How it affects my life is, I haven't been able to work for 8 years, simply because I can't sit for that long. I don't sleep very well, so I could be awake all night. That affects, and even pain affects your cognitive processes. So you literally can't think. You forget your word.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you know, what happens now, I'm sure maybe it always happened. A doctor will say, you know, what is your pain 0 to 10? Do you know what I mean? And they must have a scale within that where they go, right, if it's above such and such, it's not. And 10 is pretty much unbearable, but you have to bear it. So what, from a scale of 0 to 10, you know, where do you sit at averagely with chronic pain? Or maybe even before you were diagnosed might be better, Martina, because hopefully you're getting some better relief now.
Before I was diagnosed, it would have been at the 9 or 10.
Wow.
During the summer, you know, training now, so summer is over, September, I think, it was up at the 9 or 10. I started a new treatment regimen, so it's gone down now to about a 6 on a daily basis. So the biggest thing you have to do is pacing. It's, and I've often said to people, oh, this is the new 4-letter word for us now, you have to get used to it. And it's planning out your day. It's doing a small bit. For example, you have to clean your house. So instead of cleaning the whole house in one burst, whether you're feeling good or not, you might sweep the floor and then you take a break. You let your energy build back up. Then you might do the wash up, and that might be it for the day. And you have to wait then for the following day to do the next bit. Mm-hmm.
And, it makes an awful lot of sense for us, though, to approach this differently, because I'm not sure what the situation with you, Martina, was, but with other people with sort of like invisible issues or issues that maybe aren't mainstream or as common as others, they tie up so many different consultancies, they get so many different diagnoses. So you get one diagnosis, you treat that for 6 months, it doesn't work, you're back to the drawing board. And then, of course, that obviously is going to generate mental health issues for some. So that could be another pathway to treatment. If we reset and say, right, let's change our approach, we actually use less resources, less money, and we give, as best as possible, a lot of people a better quality of life. And rather these eureka moments that someone has, be it Lyme disease or endometriosis or whatever it might be, where there comes this point, it seems to be generally late in life, in the 20s or something, where finally they get believed and they get treatment. And it's so familiar, the story, but still so shocking every time you hear it from a unique perspective.
Absolutely. We would call for, you know, the multidisciplinary approach, what's called the biopsychosocial approach, which is the holistic approach. Treat the whole body so that in one place you have the physiotherapist, you have the occupational therapist, you have the mental health therapist, which in whichever guise they are, and you have your pain specialist or whichever other discipline that you have to see. And then they're all talking to each other. You know, they're all in one place. All your records are in one place. In Ireland, we don't currently have centralized records. So if you're going to one hospital or one center for treatment, those records aren't in another one. So they don't know what's happening unless the patient tells them. And I, you know, that would be part of it as well, to have those centralized records.
Obviously, you know, our first port of call is general practitioners, GPs, and they are general practitioners.
Absolutely.
So we can't expect them to be across absolutely everything all of the time. But I wonder sometimes maybe if they could be a little bit quicker in referring someone to say that, even if there were a few red flags that say, right, okay, I'm not going to run this down for 6 months or a year. I want you referred to such and such a place. I want, and as I say, they have an awful lot to do, but I wonder, do we do that enough?
I think they do. You know, I don't think we give our GPs enough credit at times. I think part of the problem is the huge waiting lists. So even if you get the referral, you know, you're waiting on average 12 to 18 months before you see the doctor, and then you have to wait again then for the treatment. So in the meantime, it's your GP that's still trying to look after you. So they have an immense amount of work, and there is a shortage of GPs in the country. We have to remember that too.
So you talked of that moment, and a very important part of your life, I think, evidently, when finally you were diagnosed or recognized as being a chronic pain sufferer. But that's not like, yay, everything's grand now, because obviously then it's about treatment and you know, making sure everything is tailored for you as best as is possible. How are we resourced in terms of, you know, pain consultants or people that can deal with people like you with chronic pain across the country?
There is a lower number of chronic pain consultants than we would like. In the public health system, there is only the equivalent of 27 pain consultants. So that would be a whole time number. So they're doing part time in the different hospitals. And we would definitely call for an increase in that number to help people, to lower the waiting lists, you know, and get more people treated quicker, get the treatment plans up and running quicker.
And in your case, or most people's case, or can you generalise, is it chronic pain? It's about managing chronic pain for the rest of the person's lives. At what point is a decision made that there can be no intervention to ease what's causing the pain?
I couldn't say.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many treatment plans and it's so individual to everybody. But in terms of the self-management then at home, that's where Chronic Pain Ireland comes in. And I found Chronic Pain Ireland through my pain consultant. He had a sticker or a poster in the window. And we run workshops to help people with the self-management side of things. So that's the pacing, the sleep, the mental health, you know.
All right, okay. And I just think, and it's not just in this area, but there's so many. I mean, we'll talk more generally. You can't go around telling everyone all of the time what you're going through. But at the same time, then you also have to tolerate people maybe not recognizing what you're going through or understand it. And it must be incredibly frustrating.
It is. It's beyond frustrating. you know, in any situation, whether it's a work situation or even a home situation, you know, or a social, you know, you'll hear from a lot of people, oh, my social circle has decreased, because they don't have the energy to go out and socialise, especially in the evenings. They might have had a full day at work, or they've a full day at home with their children. They're trying to look after their children. And small children don't understand that mommy or daddy or their caregiver can't run around all the time. You know, yeah. I have several nieces and nephews, and they've all grown up with me having chronic pain, but they still don't understand why Martina and I just can't walk out to the park with them, or can't chase them around the garden.
Yeah.
You know, sit down on the floor, or sit down on the couch might be the best thing you can do with them.
I get you. Martina, thanks for helping us to understand. We really appreciate your time. I hope you're feeling as good as you can do at this time. And is winter worse or summer, or does it matter? Or
winter can be worse. Cold weather for me in particular. Other people would find the heat worse. Can I give a shout out to our website?
Of course you can. Do whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. So Chronic Pain Ireland, we have our own website. It's chronicpain.ie. We also have a Facebook page and a Twitter page, and all our events for Pain Awareness Month this September will be up on the website.
All right, okay. Thank you very much indeed for your time this morning, Martina. Take care of yourself. Thank you so much. That's Martina Phelan, Chair of Chronic Pain Ireland. Okay, now, today the Mental Health Commission published its reports into the provision of child and adolescent mental health services, commonly known as CAMHS, in Community Healthcare Organisation 1. This covers Sligo, Leitrim, Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. The Commission's report is a damning indictment of the deepening crisis in our mental health service, and the report shows that there are long waiting lists and serious staff shortages in the CAMHS region that we are in. The three Donegal CAMHS team had the lowest staffing in the region, and one team had no psychologist, no social worker, no occupational therapist. This severely restricted the therapeutic interventions available to young people. And overall, the Mental Health Commission's Dr. Susan Finnerty, having published an overall report, found children are subject to a postcode lottery in getting essential mental health services. And she said that, following her inspection, she could not provide an assurance to parents that their children have access to a safe, effective and evidence-based mental health service. Fiona Coyle is CEO of Mental Health Reform. Thank you for joining us, Fiona. And this paints, it's a national scandal, I think I would describe it as, and a very, very dark picture.
Yeah, it's a stark reflection, I think, Greg, of, you know, the state of our mental health services, in particular for children and young people. You know, there's a real lack of standardized care and access, which is really concerning. You know, every child, every young person should have access to high quality, appropriate mental health service, regardless of where they live. And, you know, we really need strong leadership, accountability and really immediate actions to this. Like, I think, as you said, it's a national scandal and it should be treated as such. Like, the first report has been out, you know, it's almost a month and a half now, and we've not heard a commitment from the Taoiseach or any of the coalition partners that this is a priority issue for them. So we really need it to be recognised by, you know, the highest higher levels of government if we're going to have any effect or any change from these really damning reports.
Because if it's something like, and I'm not in any way comparing issues, if it's something like water issues, lots of people are affected and they can get together and organise and what have you. Unfortunately, these are individual battles families are fighting. You know, they're not coordinated in any way, shape or form. And unfortunately, when issues are like that, even though it affects so many people, but because they don't have a united voice, and I know Mental Health Reform is offering that, but if you understand where I'm coming from, it doesn't seem to get as much interest from political parties as perhaps it should.
Yeah, no, you make a very good point. And a lot of the families and indeed the young people that I speak to, they feel alone and they feel like they don't want to, especially the families, they don't want to speak out on behalf of their child because there's still so much stigma surrounding accessing mental health services and supports. And people feel, you know, that their child will be stigmatized by merely them saying that they need to seek CAM support. So I think as an issue, we need to collectively make our voice a lot louder on it. Mental health reform, like we're an umbrella organisation, so we represent over 81 community and voluntary sector organisations, many of them household names like Pieta, Jigsaw, ISPCC, who all work in delivering key services to young people. And next week, we'll be launching our pre-budget campaign. And as part of that, you know, we're asking people to contact their TDs, mm-hmm. and we're going to make it very easy for people. It's simply one click of a button from our website to get, you know, your concerns into your local TDs, because unfortunately, if we're not making the voices heard, you know, there's no family in Ireland, and certainly there's no family across Donegal that hasn't been in some way impacted by mental health difficulties. Mm. And we really need to make sure that those who are in the position of power are aware that this is a concern, you know, and this does need to be addressed. So I think, you know, if people are listening, I'd urge them to kind of have a look at our social media and become part of that mm-hmm. kind of collective voice, because only by raising it collectively are we really going to have an impact.
Yeah, and please contradict me if this isn't a fair assessment, Fiona, but what we do see in crisis situations, we've had it here in Donegal, and unfortunately we're witnessing it in Tipperary, whereby there is seen as an acute need for supports for young people. And they're much lauded and advertised and presumably well-resourced, and exactly how it should be. But if you took a step back and stood in the middle of Europe, that's a nationwide issue here at the moment, and we should be throwing all our resources and all our money and whatever supports it takes to help the many young people suffering with their mental health and other issues, because it is, as I say, a real national problem. We're seeing figures going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, no, you're completely correct. Like, this is a national problem, especially coming out of COVID. A lot of our members have seen spikes in the number of children and young people accessing their services. And the CAM support, like the CAMS supports, it's very specialised, and it is for people who are in kind of a mental health crisis. And what we're really asking for is, you know, to take a step back, as you said, how do we get support to that young person when they need it at the right time, so they don't need to escalate to a place where they need specialized support? Because, you know, we need those specialized supports to be fit for purpose. Mm-hmm. We need parents in Donegal, you know, to be accessing the same quality of supports that, you know, someone in Dublin or, you know, other areas may be. But we also need to support, you know, it's not fair on, you know, what was recognized in the reports. And something I really want to emphasize is the vital work that's being carried out by those who are in those services. Like, they are trying their best in what are very strained yeah. circumstances. And it's really, you know, there's acute staff shortages and recruitment issues, but, you know, there's a lot of burnout and overburdenment, but the staff at the front lines are doing their very best. What we need now is those who are, you know, in charge of our health services to step in and to support them as well. Yeah.
And listen, just as you're talking, a person texting in, working in this area, they're burnt out, they're understaffed, they're working long hours, and they don't feel like they're making any inroads because the problems are worsening, the workload is worsening, and it's an awful situation for anyone to be working in. But Fiona, like, some people listening will hear words CAMS, mental health, children, resources, recruitment and that kind of stuff, but what is the consequences of this? So what damage is being done by young adults and children who need the services of CAMS not getting it? So, you know, what are the consequences of the situation we find ourselves in? Some general examples as to what it actually might mean for these young people and their families.
Yeah, like I think in the report, it really what came to the fore is the frustration that parents feel and that young people feel. So if you're not accessing support and you're witnessing, you know, your family member or someone in your care or you yourself, you know, you're not getting support, your crisis may be escalating. It may be escalating to a point where you need to go to A&E for support or may need to go into an inpatient care or treatment facility. So I think not getting that right support, it's really frustrating, not only for the young person, but for the family around them, perhaps for the broader community, for the school. So it has a huge knock-on impact because, you know, you're witnessing someone who may be kind of in a place where they need support. So again, it's looking at those earlier interventions as well. And a lot of those are being delivered by community and voluntary groups.
Okay.
And there's a lack of funding being provided. You know, they haven't had an increase in the funding, although they can show that the number of people that they're supporting is increasing. They're working with the same resources that they were, but the numbers are going up. So we need a real strategic response.
Do we need to change it altogether? Because I've seen letters recently whereby positions are available and they're funded, but they can't be filled. Right, so the HSE might argue, or whomever's overall responsible might say, look, what can we do? We can't force people to move to Donegal and work in this area, or we can't force people to take up these options. And that just leaves us going in a circle. Is there a solution to that issue? Because the jobs are there, the funding seemingly is there, and this is not, this is actual CAMHS funding, but they can't fill the roles. So what can or needs to be done?
Yeah, and the recruitment issue is one across the country as well, and in particular for more rural areas. And I think what we need to invest in, which is a timely investment, it takes time, is more courses. So, you know, going back to the beginning so that more people, perhaps from Donegal, go through the education and come out as these clinicians, and, you know, they're able then to live and work in their communities, which we hear a lot of. That's what people want ultimately as well. But also it's taking a step back and seeing, okay, it's difficult for us to fill these positions, but can we invest more in other services, such as those are being provided by community and voluntary organisations, to stop, you know, the huge numbers that need to access CAMH? There'll always be individuals who'll need CAMH supports, but, you know, we can support people in different ways. So we need to kind of take a step back and look at, you know, what are the resources we have in Donegal? What are the organisations who are there supporting individuals? And how can we all work collectively to ensure that we're providing real support, timely support to that young person when they need it in their own community as well? You know, Donegal's a large place. We need to ensure that there is those community-based services.
Finally, Fiona, I beg your pardon, I don't want to do anything that actually adds to a problem because, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about mental health in this programme and encouraging people to get assistance when they need it, okay? So I'll just leave it to you, the final words. We have to talk about these things to improve things, but what if it discourages someone from seeking the help that they need or giving up? Or their situation being compounded? What's your message to them people, if that's okay?
No, that's a really good point. I think, you know, while these reports do show that there is huge gaps in our system, there's still lots of amazing supports out there for individuals. And, you know, it should never discourage you from coming forward because the support is there. A lot of what this is highlighting is more kind of governance systemic issues that, you know, that need to be resolved. But I think, you know, if people want to log on to our website, mentalhealthreform.ie, you'll see so many organizations, no matter what your concern is or the concern of your young person. If it's ADHD, we've ADHD Ireland. BodyWise or the National Eating Disorder Organization, PETA and Samaritans are always there. And there's also the text 50808 support number that if you simply, you don't want to talk to anyone, you just want to text and get a bit of support, that number is there and available as well. So there's so many supports out there, and recovery is possible as well. I think that's the main message we need to get across, that, you know, having a mental health difficulty, we need to normalize it, and we need to ensure that that people are speaking out, and when they are, that they get the support that they need. So yeah, I think we need to ensure that these reports and, you know, the coverage of it, that we aren't
it's really important because we're very careful with language that we use when we're discussing issues like suicide or other things. And I really think there's a responsibility on the media to make sure that we don't take hope away, because there is lots of supports there, but we also need to talk about things to make sure they're better for more people. Fiona, thanks for helping with that. Take care of yourself.